Nancy Ross is the main presenter, and she'll be introducing the panelists.
Thank you. We've had a few last-minute changes to this particular session. The people I was supposed to co-present with are unable to be here today. And so at the last minute, instead of canceling the crafting panel, which clearly we have a small but devoted audience, I decided to reach out to some friends and to grab a few new presenters. And so I want to introduce first, our first speaker today will be Joanna Smith, who is a Mormon feminist and is currently the executive director for Utah Women Unite. And she's a former board member of Ordained Women. And Joanna embraces every part of her Mormon homemaking past, refusing to hide her talents. And she now uses her threads to amplify her voice. Our second speaker is going to be Chandra Brooks, who was born and raised in Utah from Pioneer Stock and has always been a crafter. She was raised LDS but left 2 years ago and joined the Community of Christ. She has been married twice and divorced once and is a proud mom of 4 children and 3 fur babies. Okay, so we'll go ahead and turn the time over to Joanna.
Hello. I was asked to kind of talk about my craft journey, so I guess I'll bore you with my details of my life. As all young Mormon girls in the 80s, as I was, I was involved in activity days to teach you how to actually be a woman. And the definition of that being you learned how to iron shirts and make corn husk dolls and cross stitch and scrapbook. And I embraced that as an identity. My mother was always incredibly talented and creating things. I call her the ultimate creator. Literally and figuratively. And so I embraced that as my identity in as part of not just my Mormon identity, but who I was. So I became, after Activity Day Girls, I became an avid scrapbooker and writer because it was kind of an outlet to be able to write what I wanted. And I could claim it off as family history. And it had shiny stickers. So I was an avid scrapbooker. I got married very, very, very young. Don't do that. Don't recommend that. And then shortly thereafter, had a baby and stopped working. And then crafting became my only outlet for anything. It was like a socially acceptable outlet for my identity, if that makes sense. So I had a couple of babies in a short amount of time, and I was an avid scrapbooker. And I lived out in Atlanta, Georgia at the time. And because I was such an avid scrapbooker, I kind of was known in the community, and I had some friends that had started businesses, and they're well-known scrapbookers now in the industry. And so through some connections and stuff, I was offered a job that was a work-from-home job to be a scrapbook editor and design team lead. And I was like, yay, my craft is validated because I get money and product for what I do. And it was also, again, socially acceptable because I could do it from home and it was part-time. So I did that, and I was amazing at it. And I built like a blog and social media presence, and I kind of became an expert at that. I cultivated a design team, and I did it for an international crafting company. I did that for about 18 months, and they came to me and said, "We'd really like you to be full time. We'd like you to come to the office." And they offered me what at the time was a large sum of money per year salary position. And I told my then husband and was literally laughed at. you can't get a job that. You can't. That's not a job. And who's going to take care of the kids? And we have an autistic son. And so it was like, I'm not taking time off my job if we get called from the school. So who's going to be okay with you going twice a week to the principal's office? And I heartbreakingly turned down the job. Still regret it. And I did it, and immediately my Mormon community and my husband at the time lauded it as a sacrifice in motherhood, and I'm such a good, amazing woman. And I did that, and it legitimately, like, it broke my heart. And I haven't scrapbooked a day since. So I felt kind of stripped of what I felt like was an outlet for me. And I felt like I was robbed of a coping mechanism that I had had my whole life to still tell stories and to share my stories and to document my family history. And it was robbed from me. And in 2012, I had, so, you know, as a good Mormon, I had another baby to heal. And my mom came out. It's what we do. So my mom came out, and when I had the baby, and I got out of the hospital, she's like, okay, so we're going to quilt. And I was like, no, I'm healing. I can't sit up straight. And she's like, no, you can't move, so you got to do something with your hands, and you haven't done anything with your hands in 2 years since your heartbreak. So she was like, you're going to learn how to do this because I've always wanted to teach you, so you get to live out my dream. And for 5 days, she literally made me sit there and learn how to quilt and make quilts. And we made, I think, 2 or 3 quilts that week. And then she went home. Bye-bye. And so I've been quilting ever since. It became a new outlet that was safe without the heartbreak. And it was socially acceptable. And I started to heal because I could create. And it was a connection to my mom. It was a connection to who she was and her identity. And it was amazing. And then right around that time, I started really, really appreciating women's work and really going out of my way to support women artists and finding that everywhere and not realizing it had always been there. And so I did that. And then so shortly after that, I put up a profile on Ordained Women. And I bring that up because it's kind of vital to the shift of my thinking. So I put up a profile, and I remember I went, and I made quilts for people I love. I make, that's what I do. And so I was making quilts for people I love, and I was loving people in Ordained Women. And so I was kind of making Ordained Women-themed quilts. I think I've made 9 Ordained Women quilts. And so that became like a way I could express in a socially acceptable way to my Mormon friends my belief that women should be ordained. And then the November policy change happened. And I just barely started teaching my daughter how to quilt. And I remember just like sobbing. My mattress was on the floor at the time. And I just remember like sobbing into my mattress about this policy change. And I had a quilt up on the wall that was inspired by Gies Bend Quilters. And Gies Bend Quilters are these historical black women that were slaves and recently freed slaves that developed these amazing, beautiful techniques in quilting. And I ripped it off the wall, and I still have never finished it. I ripped it off the wall because that quilt represented to me hope, and I felt like the church gave me no hope. And so I took a whole bunch of fabrics that were left over from that quilt, and I cut out this, and I made this quilt in one night. Because I was just so dang mad. And I needed a way to express that equality had to be for everyone. And I actually have a rainbow version of this as well that I made. I was so angry that I just needed a way to create through my pain. And I just remember listening to all of the stories and all of the podcasts, and there were things coming out live version that night, and I just listened to them, and I turned on angry breakup music, and I created this quilt. And I think at that moment, things changed for me from crafting to art as activism. And that was like a shift for me. And that the following month, or maybe it was 2 months later, no, it was December of 2015, I went to the High Museum of Art in Atlanta. And in it, on the upper floors, they have a series of quilts. I highly recommend anyone go to the museum for any reason. But in it is quilts made by women in the Deep South. And they were made just right around post-slavery time. And they were made out of whatever they could. Flour sacks, wrappers. And one of them, I literally like turned the corner and saw it and just started bawling. And it just was repeated over and over again, the words freedom, 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 freedom. And all like intricately hand-stitched. And I was like, well, I'm doing it wrong. I need to be doing my craft in a way that woman who made that quilt, you could feel her desire for what she wanted, and you could feel her prayer for what she wanted generations later. And so so that kind of changed, and now I almost exclusively do activist-ish quilts. I was also on the Ordained Women board, and we did an action about – it's actually downstairs. You can see it. It's this big, beautiful metal arch with keys hung on it to represent that women want to hold the keys to the priesthood and that they're willing to go on record to do so. So I highly recommend that if you believe women should get the priesthood, you participate in this art project. You can go downstairs. You can write your name on a key and put it on the gate, hoping for the day that the gates are open to women having the priesthood, and then you ring the bell, and it's quite amazing. So then I became more active in making quilts. This quilt, actually, I gave to one of my best friends, Kate Kelly, who started Ordained Women. And then I started just making more quilts and doing more things. So I'm making an equality quilt that is just like the freedom quilt that I saw in Atlanta, but it's invisible equality, which is the words equality, but they variegate. So the first one's actually, you can't, it's all just a white strip. And then you can slowly see the words as it goes up. I'm making one that's pride in breaking boxes because I have a wonderful, amazing lesbian Mormon friend that is an amazing activist here in Salt Lake community. And she challenged everyone to create some sort of visual art project for women and underrepresented communities about how they break through their own boxes. So I've created a quilt for her that is Pride in Breaking the Boxes. And it's this rainbow box quilt. And I've created, I'm finishing, like moments away from finishing. I have been working on for a year. I love the church, and I have spent 4 years trying to actively stay in the church and not get excommunicated because of ordained women. And in the last year, I found myself being okay, letting go certain parts of that. And I think, so for me, Tyler Glenn's album, I found to be a beautiful art expression. So I made a I Found Myself When I Lost My Faith Tyler Glenn quilt. Because I needed to heal and I needed to let go of the church in ways that I didn't really want to. But I still needed to like maintain my Mormonism in ways I really wanted to. So I created a quilt for that. And so so for me, craftivism has kind of shifted and become my way to make sure that my legacy of, or I guess my testimony and my beliefs last longer than I do. So I also, so I run a nonprofit that advocates for political equality in Utah, and our first action was doing the Women's March in D.C., getting 1,000 women from Utah to go to D.C., and then doing it at the Capitol as well. And so we, you better know what one of these is. This is a Pussycat hat. And so this, to me, has become like my symbol of what craftivism can be. My Aubrey, she's in the audience, she made this for me. So this, to me, has kind of become my symbol of what craftivism is, and that is using your amazing, beautiful talents to spread a message that can reach everybody so that now worldwide, like, you can literally wear this and people can identify you and people understand what, that it means, you know, building women, women building women. And I love that. So so there you go. That's my story of what craftivism means to me.
So I have to say, as Jonna started talking and relating her childhood and early adulthood, I felt like I was looking in a mirror a little bit. Raised LDS, did the activity days where we learned. They attempted to teach me how to crochet. Still not very good at it. I had 4 or 5 people try and teach me how to knit with needles. Still can't do it. But I learned the whole sew on a button, how to make a button, stitch a buttonhole by hand, you know, very simple crafts, things that I would learn with my grandmother. And the big one for me as a child growing up was baking. My mom was loved to bake, so baking bread, and that is a whole craft in and of itself. And as I hit high school graduation, got married, had children, had 3 children in 4 years, found myself a very angry, frustrated, overwhelmed young mother who baked probably 20 loaves of bread a week because kneading dough was the only way to keep my sanity. And through pregnancies, though, I would also sit and cross-stitch. Everything was always a gift to everyone, even when I was baking all of that bread. It was once I was done, pack the kids up, walk around the neighborhood, and give them to different neighbors. Everyone always loved when they saw me coming up the street with baked goods because they knew it was something that I was bringing to them. And I learned how to sew as a young mother. All of a sudden I got in my mind that my mom had made matching dresses for me and my sisters when we were kids, and I wanted that for my kids, and they hated it. if you were to ask him right now, what do you think of the matching dress that your mom made you? I hated it. But it was learning this craft and trying to fit into this mold that I really never quite fit into of what an LDS woman was supposed to be or what I was told an LDS woman was supposed to be. All the women in my world, all the adult women as a child had been stay-at-home moms. There really weren't working moms. You'd have the odd one here or there, but even the working moms still did all the crafty stuff. They still did all the baking. They were still the room mothers, and so this was my ideal as to what a woman was. You served on the PTA board. You worked in primary. You did, you made your own bread. You made meals every night. You did homemade clothes as much as you could. You created for your family. And I reached a point where it was just overwhelming, and I stepped back from everything for a few years. And part of that was going through a divorce. I had to take a really huge step back. And then when I looked at my kids and when I'm making Easter dresses, they all looked at me and went, don't make a match, please. So I made the Easter dresses. They didn't match. I didn't even use matching patterns for them. So they were moderately okay with it. Of course, having tomboys, they still weren't really thrilled with dresses. And then about four or five years ago, we were living in a duplex, had a very traumatic event occur where the people living in the duplex, the unit above us, unbeknownst to us, were involved in a drug cartel. And I was out getting my garden boxes ready to plant my vegetables and heard a noise and turned around, and behind me in rushing into my yard and yelling at me to get out of the way were a whole crew of DEA agents in protective gear with automatic weapons, and my two youngest children, one of them's right here, they were inside, and I'm being pushed out of the yard and watching a battering ram go through my upstairs neighbor's door, hearing guns cock, hearing yells of get down on the floor, we'll shoot, and all I'm doing is standing in my neighbor's driveway sobbing hysterically because my most precious things are in that house, my children, and I don't know if they're going to be safe. And it actually took the little Spanish next-door neighbor, Grandma, who just started screaming at these DEA agents in Spanish. One of them, I guess, understood her, and they finally got me into the house. Thankfully, no guns were discharged, but it triggered PTSD. And it was fairly serious. It took about 4 weeks for the effects to fully hit, and when they did, it took a trip to the ER and seeing a psychiatrist and doing a lot of therapy. And I managed it okay, got to the end of it. My husband, who does have some mental health issues, once I was stable, he kind of broke, and we had to put him in the hospital. And so we had a rocky summer, and a few months later, I had another trigger on my PTSD and ended up time off of work again. And I went in to my therapist, and my therapist noticed that I had some bald patches on my head. And she asked what that was about. And as I was talking to her, she watched as my hands kept going through my hair, and I was literally pulling my hair out of my head. And she said, you need to find something to do with your hands that will keep your hands occupied while everything else is going on around you, whether it's knitting, crocheting, cross-stitch, doing plastic canvas, drawing. I laughed when she said drawing because I can't even draw a stick figure that looks halfway decent. But I thought, okay, well, I had a friend give me some of those round knitting looms. So I looked up on the internet, saw how they worked, tried to do a hat, kind of laughed at myself and went, okay, well, we're going to try this again. Tried it again, realized that, well, for this to work, I actually needed one of those funky little tools they had to be able to move the yarn rather than the skewers I was using. So we went and got me one of the tools, and I started making some hats. And I found that I could sit and watch TV or listen to everything going on around me. And as long as my hands were active, my anxiety stayed down. And so I made a hat for my husband, made hats for a couple of friends, figured out how to make little headbands, made coasters, figured out how to make washcloths all off of these round looms, learned how to make a blanket off of the round looms, and just slowly started doing that. And I was happy doing it, and I felt much calmer. And I had people telling me, you do so good at coming up with new designs. You really ought to be selling these. And I went as far as setting up an Etsy storefront, but I never went live with it because I thought it didn't feel right to profit off of something that was just for my mental health. And we left the LDS church, and during this time, I'd had carpal tunnel syndrome. I couldn't do the knitting. I couldn't hold on to the tool long enough to be able to flip the yarn over. And I was very frustrated as I was dealing with a lot of my questions as I was leaving the LDS faith. And I finally, you know, just took a few deep breaths, thought, you know, when it's time for me to pick it back up, I know I'll be able to. Threw myself at cooking for a little while because I could do that moderately okay still. And as soon as I was cleared and able to start doing the loom knitting again, I picked it back up. And as we started exploring Community of Christ, I started dragging my loom knitting with me to church. People were asking me what I was doing, and I was, you know, I'm just making dishcloths, or I'm just making hats, or what have you. And then someone in the congregation talked about this neat thing called manna bags. And I thought, okay, well, what's a manna bag? Had it explained, you know, we go out, take these out to the homeless. They have little toiletry items, a pair of socks. We try and put a dollar or two in for them, any, you know, like $5 gift cards and that. We're going to go down to Pioneer Park and distribute these. And they put out a call for everyone to bring hats or blankets or anything like that that they had extra to give. Well, I had been making all these hats. I had a stockpile, so I thought, I'll take those with and hand them out. And as I'm handing them out, I'm realizing through my struggle, I'm actually helping someone else. And it was an amazing moment of probably the first time in my adult life where I actually felt like I was walking in Christ's footsteps. And so I thought, okay, you know, I have these other things. People will contact me. Hey, can you make this for me? And I still do that on occasion. But typically now I sit and I'll drag stuff to church, pretty much wherever I'm going, and sit and knit while people talk. And it has become such a love for me that it, when everyone's making their New Year's resolutions this year, and I'm here seeing all my friends on Facebook say that, you know, they're going to try and get healthier, or they're going to do this, they're going to do that, I'm like, I'm going to make 52 hats this year. I'm way behind. But my goal, and it still stands, I'm going to make 52 hats this year. And what I'm going to do with those 52 hats is whenever I see someone who looks like they need a hat, I'm going to give them a hat. Even if they probably don't necessarily need a hat, if they just have that look, if they need to know that someone loves them, that's something tangible. Someone made this. They gave it to me because they felt like I was in need. And, you know, I'll randomly, there'll be one sitting in the car, and I've looked at my husband and went, pull over. And he's like, why? And I'm like, just pull over. So he does, because he doesn't want me to yell. And he pulls over, and I'll hop out, and I run over, and I go, here, you look like you could use a hat. And I always get the funniest look, and they, oh, okay, and, you know, can I give you a hug? Sure. And they give me a hug, and I hop back in the car. And it's, so for me, the knitting has become my way of being more of an activist. It's I love what Joanna does. For me, it's very much taking my own struggles and turning them around from a struggle and putting it into a tangible use that I can see is needed out there right now. And I absolutely love doing the crafts. I no longer feel like I'm doing it to prove that I'm a woman as much as I'm doing it to just feel good. And I have to laugh as I've done this. I got contacted, a friend of mine in this group on Facebook. She's like, you ought to come join my group that's on Facebook. We meet once a month. I said, what's the name of your group? She goes, well, most of us are needle knitters. I'm like, okay. And she goes, we call ourselves the Dirty Needles. Okay, and they knit stuff. When their group meets, they knit stuff for hospice. And another friend of mine does crochet and is in a crochet group, and she's like, well, you ought to come because you know a little bit of crochet. We could teach you more. You ought to come join our crochet hook or crochet group. And I'm like, okay. And this friend, I'm like, I know you've got to be in a group that's got some weird name. So what's the name of it? And she says, we're the Happy Hookers. I was like, okay. Like, maybe not, but I am part of some loom knitting groups, and everyone in these groups are all involved in making hats for veterans or for active military or for homeless shelters, youth shelters, and we share our designs freely. We just say, you know, if you happen to decide to sell it, please let me know. I at least want to know that you're profiting off of it. And for the most part, if we do sell someone else's design, we always kick back some money to him because it was their pattern design. But it's something that is becoming a larger movement than I think most people are willing to see at this point. So.
Thank you. Thank you both. And if you missed the intro, my original co-presenters were not able to be here today. And so
closer to me, Nancy.
Okay. Sorry about that. Nice. So they weren't able to be here today, and so we've gone in a more experiential direction with our conversation about craft today. But I am not a crafter. I don't really make things. I'm an art historian, and over the last few years, my art history work has taken on, or my art history teaching has taken on a much more feminist bent. And this past spring, I taught a class on 20th century art history, and we spent a lot of time talking about art as protest. And especially with the Mexican Revolution and just various movements. You know, the early 20th century is really a period of change, and so many artists from the early 20th century are trying to create new directions in art, which is largely a protest against the traditionalism, the realism, the academy in art, and the traditions of art. And so near the end of the semester, we had this summing up conversation about art as protest, and one student commented that when you protest, you don't run to the store to get supplies, you just use the materials you have and you make a statement. And when she said that, I felt super embarrassed because maybe the day before the Women's March in January, I spent a significant amount of time running around St. George looking for a local printer who could print my Star Wars, A Woman's Places in the Resistance poster for me, and got it laminated. And I bought plenty of craft supplies for the poster making party that we still had with a few friends and their kids and my kids before the march. And even though I had previously purchased some poster board the day before, I decided that we really needed foam core. So yeah, maybe I keep protesting that I don't make things, but you know, if I'm doing crafting, I have my standards. So when I first when Jennifer Basquiat first talked about putting together a session on crafting and craftivism and critiques of this, I was very interested in critiquing crafting and craftivism as a performance of whiteness. And this is something I've been thinking about a lot this last year. I'm recently changed departments, so I'm not in an art department anymore. I'm in an integrated studies department. And this fall, I'll be teaching a class on whiteness. And so I've been thinking a lot about the performance of whiteness and what does that mean and what does that look like? And I had very strong initial ideas about what I would say and how I would critique pussy hats specifically. And I want to put that on hold for a moment, because I spent a lot of the last number of months trying to get more background information, and also trying to understand, too, that the very word that we use, craft, is largely a gendered one. And there's a reason why we don't call them artists, and that's sexism, right? And that we use sometimes other words to describe the kinds of art that women make that delegitimize it in our culture, and that is hugely problematic and always has been. And art history is the worst offender of this discipline. You know, in art history, we study things like oil painting and sculpture and architecture, largely ignoring the decorative arts and other kinds of art that people make. And so then I was like, you know, and I listened to a bunch of crafting podcasts. Apparently there are a lot of crafting podcasts out there. And I listened to the kinds of craftivism that people were talking about. And I tried to think, well, beyond pussy hats, what does craftivism look like? It looks like making pads for Days for Girls. It looks like making hats for babies in hospitals. And that's been, you know, a craftivist activity that's been around for a really long time. It looks like making warm clothes for refugees in cold climates that arrive without the proper clothing. And it looks like a lot of different things. And that really what we call craft today was really a few generations ago need. You know, need to make socks for your family, a need to make blankets and warm things. And that craft has always been used by a lot of different cultures in the United States to create visual culture and to mark heritage. I'm thinking about quilts made by slave women to document the oral history knowledge that they brought with them through the Middle Passage. And we only have a handful of those on display in American institutions and American museums today. But there are lots of ways in which a lot of cultures have important visual arts, decorative arts, that maybe are associated with women and women's production, and we devalue those. So it's like, dang it, I just wanted this to be a simple critique, and I wanted this to be an easy critique. And so you know, we don't want to acknowledge the complexity of our critiques. It's often just easier to be simple about it. I was talking to my sister-in-law last night, who's very invested in craft but doesn't like to broadcast that because of all the stereotypes associated with crafters. And she told me that crafting is a relationship, and that crafting helps create relationships when she engages in it, and that it helps build relationship with people she does not know, maybe women, other women in her ward. It creates intergenerational relationships as older women pass on the skills that they learned in their younger years. And in a world, I think our world largely resists intergenerational relationships, and crafting helps to build bridges. She said she feels easily belittled by others for craft, for feeling that maybe, and as crafters are often charged with, you know, crafters are often charged with having too much time, and it being a very white middle class activity. She doesn't want to share her projects, but she liked Uchtdorf's talk where he said that we are wired to create, and she felt that she was wired to create. And though I had not known this about her, despite knowing her for many years, but she showed me her portfolio book of the grief dolls that she makes. She is a Relief Society president, and when she knows that people are experiencing grief in her community, she hand makes a special doll for that person, maybe there are visual suggestions of the person who has passed away, but it is an object to help someone process grief. And I didn't know this, and I was very touched by her very large portfolio of grief dolls. And so clearly there's a lot of good things that, you know, craft and crafting and craftivism, or the arts, as we also know them, there's a lot of important stuff there. And maybe there's a lot of interpersonal relationship building, intergenerational relationship building, and service that happens in our communities as a resulting of craft and craftivism. And all of that is important, and it's good. So where do we encounter problems? For the Women's March, there were a lot of pink hats. And I do not believe that the making of the pink hats is a problem. But when I looked at photographs that I searched through Google Images, I didn't see a lot of those hats appearing in other contexts. So if the messaging of the hats is about solidarity with women and promotion of women's issues, when I looked at photos of the Dakota Pipeline water protectors, I didn't really see pussy hats. And when I looked at other protests that were happening at a similar time, I didn't see a lot of pussy hats. And so if the message of pussy hats is that we have to show up, right? We have to show up, then we need to show up, right? And it can't just be for the Women's March. We need to be showing up in other contexts for other people with our symbols of solidarity, or our symbols are ringing a little hollow. And so that is kind of what I wanted to say about crafting today. So there's a lot of good to craft. There's a lot of complexity to craft, the visual arts, the decorative arts. But we also need to make sure that when we're making things for communities, that we're working with them to make the things that they need. We need to make sure that our symbols are the symbols that we want them to be, and they have to show up in many contexts, especially things like pussy hats, which are for solidarity. But ultimately, the conclusion I came to, which is that crafting in and of itself is not a performance of whiteness, but it can cross over into that when we focus more effort on creating those feelings of solidarity without acting them out and engaging. So that when we engage in our craftivism, that it's thoughtful, and that we are going to show up and show up consistently for what we are professing. So I want to end there, and my guess is that we've got a room full of crafters here. And so I'm going to turn it back to the moderator for questions and comments.
I'll come to you.
No, the hat. Oh. It's warming out. It's hot.
Maybe depending on if I can get that far.
We can come to the center.
Thanks for having this panel. I came here excited to hear about stuff, but I didn't really think of myself as a crafter. It does have a lot of kind of connotations. And I was never that kind of a girl. But I recently went back to school, and I have anxiety and some attention issues and needed something to do with my hands, and playing solitaire didn't really work anymore. And I started crocheting last year. I was surprised at how soothing and empowering it was. And I just make blankets because you do the same thing for a long time, and then you just have to figure out how to get back going the other way, and then you can just keep going. So there's very little attention you have to give to it. But I have to share with you that I ended up making. So I just started in last May, and by Christmas time, I had like 12 blankets. The yarn that I bought. I became one of those people that was like, I went to Michael's, oh no. But so I gave these blankets for Christmas to the women that were close to me, and I included a little tag because I thought it was funny that I was crocheting because I was in graduate school studying about how my focus was on how Mormon culture really shapes women's aspirations, so that that we're just focused on stuff in the home. But here I am, like, crocheting. And with some of the issues I have, I learn better. I have all this reading I had to do. And if I can get it in audio form, I do better. But I have to be busy. So I made all of these blankets listening to, like, feminist theory, dense, stuff. And so when I gave these as presents, I included a tag, and so it said, "Congratulations, you now own a piece of feminist crochet. Each piece of feminist crochet was handmade while a woman pursued her education. As she crocheted, she learned how systems reproduce inequality and their sociocultural context, the art of community organizing, and the aspect of a feminist research paradigm. And so each stitch marks an increase in the power a woman has to create positive change, both in her own life and in her community. This yarn could not help but soak up such empowerment and will now bestow upon its owner a sense of badass awesomeness and radical self-respect. Please act accordingly."
I'm going to make a copy of that.
Yeah.
I love it.
Question. So I'm sitting here thinking about what you said about the words we use for it and how they're designed to sort of devalue what women do. I come from very creative parents. My father mainly painted oil paintings, which nobody ever said wasn't art. My mother did a lot of sewing and other creative things. And was quite the feminist, but people didn't talk about it as art in the same way they talked about what my dad did. So I don't know where I'm going with that, other than maybe wanting to hear more from the panel about your views on the language we use and maybe changing the language we use.
So the Loom group that I'm most active with through social media was actually started by a man who lost his wife and was trying to help his kids cope with the loss of their mother. And this group actually has more men than women, which is fairly unique. And I actually think when it comes to the handcrafts, that everyone recognizes that women do it, but that's where the inequality is because not every woman does the handicrafts. It's probably an equal amount of men who do it. My dad hand sews quilts, but he does woodworking too. They recognize as woodworking and think my stepmom makes the quilts. I think part of what it is for us to stand up and say, this is every bit as much art. This takes as much thought and work in the creative process that painting and oil painting does. I have kids who paint, and I see what they go through as they paint, and I see their process and the way they stop and think about it, and as they select their materials. And it's the same thing I do as I walk into Michael's and they go, "Oh, are you here for more yarn?" I'm sure I'm not the only one to have ever heard that. Same thing happens at Joanne's now, too. And the amount of time I spend pondering over the yarn and what I'm going to buy and what I'm going to create with it, I know the same amount of time an artist spends over a painter spends over their colors, what type of medium they're going to use, you know, what type of canvas they're going to use, that the process in thought is the same even if the outcome is something completely different. And that's where we need to start getting, in my opinion, that shift.
I went through a good 10 years where I hated the word craft. When I got that job with a national company, I heard my dad describe it as Joanna got herself a little crafting gig. And so I hated it after that. I now like it again. I like that someone will come up to me and say, you made this for me, and it has held me in dark times. I quilt subversive things in all of my quilts, so there's like words or poetry or hidden vaginas in them. And so, like, I've had French children call me years later and say, I just read the poem that was on my quilt that I've been snuggling with for 3 years, and I needed it at that moment. So now I kind of own the word crafting, but it's taken probably 10 years of hating it, because I sewed leather, and that was art for other people, but it was Joanna's crafting thing when I did it. So I like it now, but it's almost a reclaiming of the word, much as like a lot of feminist words that we are reclaiming now.
As a non-crafter, I'm not really sure that I feel very qualified to weigh in here, but I feel like there are other terms that receive more respect.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring this up because I thought I think it's kind of interesting that I hang out in lots of in drag communities here, and I'm in like a few drag collectives, troupes, and there's a lot of overlap with the with craft communities, and I think it's kind of interesting that's like this queer culture, we don't really like necessarily like the clear labels, and so there's not like a clear distinction between like performance art and lip syncing. There's not a clear distinction between art and craft, and yeah, a lot of these drag performers, like, they, what they make as clothes is oftentimes incorporating like crafting, and then our set designs, like lots of times people spend a lot of time creating these like really large and interesting and sometimes space-based crafts, and so yeah, it's just interesting to see how that plays out in queer community building, like the role that craft/craft art, whatever we end up calling it, what it ends up playing in those communities.
I can vouch for that. My brother was in a show one time, and it was like amazing and over the top, and it's a crafting to a new level. No comments?
I do want to say that in the last probably 2 years, as I've been more open with owning kind of subversive crafting, I found a lot more of those intersections with the queer community, with the trans community, with other communities that I have been genuinely surprised about, because stereotypically I didn't assume that there were other people other than traditional trope people doing it. So it has actually been like really fun for me. It's made me try new mediums and made me more brave in my crafting, because I'm finding new ways to connect with it through other people that and through new lenses, and I find that really fun.
I've got two things, and I think one of them is that for those of us who are not crafters, I think we have to own some of the lack of respect that is afforded to crafters, because I have been in more situations than I care to admit where people would say things like, oh, I'm not one of those artsy, crafty women. You know, I've got real things to do. So I think a number of us have to own that we have added to the lack of respect that crafters have received. And for any part that I've played in that, I want to say that I am sorry. I think the other thing that I know, and I'm not trying to speak for all women of color, but I think certainly there is a feeling in some parts of the black community when they look at some of the crafting, and particularly the quilting, that somehow something that belonged to us has been taken. That may be a misconception, that may be rewriting history, but I could line up countless old black ladies in here who would state very strongly to you that they are the ones who quilted. They are the ones who came up with all these wonderful ways to quilt, and that white women came into the communities and looked at what they were doing, took what they were doing, and went and started making money off of it. Because I am not a quilter, I don't know the truth of that, but I do know that that is a perception that's out there.
Yeah. I think that's a really valid perception. I do know that quilting, I've done a lot of research in quilt history and whatnot, and there are Polynesian women that quilt a certain way, and they have a special style of needle turning, and there are styles that have been around for generations. There are European women that have made quilts and embroidery on quilts for a very long time. And I know that the African tradition has had quilts for a very long time. What I think you're correct on is that white women's quilts get lauded as art more. And I mean, not enough, but I think that when people see it, that's what they see, and I think that that is highly problematic. One, because I think it erases the history of so many. Actually, there's a huge quilting presence in Japan that has been around for a very, very, very long time, and their techniques are wildly different, but. For some reason, it's white women monetizing on it, leading the industry in quilt designing and fabric making and, pattern selling. And I think that that's highly problematic. I validate that that's a huge problem, and I wish that there was more history in unifying quilts around the world, because to me, I belong to a quilt guild as well, and so I'm a minority in saying what I'm about to say, and that is that to me, I find it really unifying with women around the world. And that there's this intense desire that's been around for hundreds and hundreds of years to create something of utilitarian yet beautiful purpose that outlives them. I find that very unifying and beautiful. I don't believe that the average woman in my quilt guild would say that. So,
I think what you just described is diversity in quilting. I was a bit concerned to hear the term white, whatever it is that you said about the history, because I've spent quite a bit of time in the last few years learning about black history, learning to appreciate August Wilson and jazz, you know, and what you're describing is the commercialization of quilting is what happened in music in the 30s the same way. So I'd like to have a little bit better definition of what you meant by whiteness or the term that you used in the history.
So there have been a number of people who've theorized about the performance of whiteness or whiteness as a performance. Ruth Frankenberg is a sociologist who spent a lot of time talking about taking off of, you know, Judith Butler talks about gender as a performance and but also whiteness as a performance. And I'm still think, as a scholar, I'm still trying to understand whiteness as a performance. But I think that it speaks to the things that Brindis was talking about, at least in some parts, which is that sometimes the performance of whiteness is taking something from another culture and claiming it as our own without giving any credit to the history of that thing. So we would call that cultural appropriation. Is a performance of whiteness. But also then a performance of whiteness can look like an ignorance of that as well. So then engaging in cultural appropriation, but then also being ignorant of it. And so then claiming something as white men that is our own when maybe there's a history there and there are dynamics there that we are not aware of. And then when that's pointed out to us, sometimes being willfully ignorant about those processes. So I think that the issue of cultural appropriation is one that's very relevant to this conversation. And so I think that I also think that there's a problem when we as white women decide that something helps us feel connection with women around the world when maybe that is never reciprocated by those women we are supposedly feeling connection with, right? And so so Joanna spoke to the sense of unification, but I also wonder, what does that feel like to be unified? Does that feel unifying, or does that feel like something else? And so I think that there are some challenging issues there. You know, how do we feel connection across culture? And then do those people who we feel a connection across culture with reciprocate that feeling of connection across culture, or is there a different view of that, right? And I think that these are always things that we have to think about when we engage in any kind of cultural practice, right? And we don't want to, because we want to feel, you know, if we feel unified, you know, that feels good, right? We want to kind of go with our good feelings. But sometimes our good feelings have impact that is more complicated. And so all of that territory, whether that is white women feeling like they're creating connections across culture that may or may not be reciprocated, but maybe we're not really looking to find out, or maybe that's ignorance, or maybe that's cultural appropriation. I would say that all these things would constitute a performance of whiteness. You know, using the symbol of the pussycat as a unifier of all women in the United States when it wasn't, right? Like that can be a performance of whiteness. I also at the same time hesitate to say it's a performance of whiteness all the time or in every case, because there were women of color wearing pussycats as well, right? And So then there's this really important symbol, and it's like, how is this symbol being used, and where is this symbol showing up, and what is the complexity of the politics of the symbol, and right, like those aren't simple things, right? Those are complex things, right? And it's really easy to kind of write people off, but that doesn't really acknowledge the complexity of a situation. And so I think we want to see, or what I would encourage us to see, is craft is complex. But also that if we're engaging in the process of craft, that we are trying to fully understand and go all the way through for carrying out our ideas and thinking them through and thinking like, am I aware of the history of this? right?
Yeah. So doing our homework, really. Right. Like, so I kind of spoke earlier about Gaze Bend. Gaze Bend quilts are just, they're beautiful. And the history behind them is just, I mean, heart-wrenchingly beautiful. And I remember I was quilting in Atlanta, and I had a friend that was a quilter. She was a black woman, and we were good quilting friends, and we joked, and we had a very good connection. And I remember I was out shopping with her one time at an outdoor mall, and we walked by Pottery Barn that had a quilt hanging in the window. And it was a commercialized Gaze Bend quilt. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's beautiful. And she was heartbroken. This was her identity. And they were selling that quilt for $500 a quilt. And this was her literal heritage. So I think that recognizing what it is that we do and who it affects and who it impacts and the history in the past and going forward is vital to responsible citizenship, regardless of if it has to do with crafting or colonialism or book writing. I mean, anyone I know who's in the scrapbooking industry or in any sort of creative industry, in the art industry, they'll go to great lengths to protect their work with watermarks if they're a photographer, and with hidden images if they're a graphic designer, and encrypted files if they're a writer. Like, they go to great lengths to protect their work. And I think that too often white people will steal minority people's work in crafting and the art world and the writing world and pick anywhere. They will steal trans women's work because it's easy to silence people that are already a minority. And so I think that it's really, really important that we recognize those intersections and who it affects and what it affects and what is honoring and what is appropriation and what is colonialism, and all the way down to the point of, I won't buy fabrics at certain stores anymore because some of them are still produced in countries that use slave labor. But just being aware is vitally important for the respect that you would give yourself. Like, so you brought up, like, oh, well, we've patterns, and if we sell them, then we give a little bit to the person who made the pattern. Like, so we do that within our own small circles, but are we doing that on a broader context?
I'll go to you after. Sorry. It's quick. So we've talked about, like, appropriation and profit. And it was interesting because both of you, when you talked about your crafting history, talked about how you were each a little reticent to accept money. Like, you gave away your bread. You felt like you couldn't profit off of, you couldn't sell things. You had an amazing job offer, right? And it wasn't acceptable to profit off of these types of things, like individually as a person. And then when you started to make these beautiful, amazing quilts, you gifted all of them. So I'm interested in that. Like, we've talked about craft, and it's less than art, right, in society's view. Well, sure, like, even monetarily, right? Like, there's no value monetarily to what you're producing. And yet I see this in my own community. We had a PTA fundraiser with a beautiful quilt that, like, I'm like, okay, I've quilted. That's hours upon hours. And it was getting bids of, like, $30, $35. And I was just like, what is up with this? And everyone in the room, I shouldn't say everyone, knew how much time and effort went into that. But that, to me, spoke volumes of, like, what women's time and effort is valued. So what are your thoughts about that? Like, as you've moved on in your crafting, have you realized, well, if I did want to sell something on Etsy, would I be a bad person? Is it okay for me to profit on something I've spent time and money doing?
–
So not having the ability to be a stay-at-home mom where I'm a working person, every hour I spend crafting is important. And on the occasions that I do sell my product that I make, I sell it for cost of materials plus $10 an hour. And I've had people tell me, you charge too much. I can get it for less from someone else. And I said, that's fine. Go ahead and get it from someone else. I've already bought material, so you're going to have to reimburse me for that anyways. I more often than not have at some point a written agreement of the cost between us, and I let them know, you know, you agreed to this, you said yes, this stands up in the court, and I'm not afraid. And when it comes to that, you know, I won't let my work be devalued if I'm being requested to do something, because a hat, I've been watching you do your hat here, and it can take, depending on a pattern, it can take anywhere from maybe an hour or two to 8, 9, 10 hours, depending on, and sometimes even longer, depending on how intricate it is. And if you are creating a design, the amount of time it puts in, if someone wants something to look a certain way and you're having to go back and undo it and start over, that is your time. And I let him know, you know, I'm not even charging you what I get paid at my job. And I am someone who was a stay-at-home mom who walked into the workforce with no marketable skills. So I don't have the best paying job. But I'm an administrative assistant now. My time is money. And if you're going to devalue it, then I'll find someone else who wants it, or I'll take that and I'll go down the street to the youth shelter and say, hey, I've made some hats. Would you like one? So,
I have super strong opinions about that. I make 24 quilts a year, and they're, I mean, just the materials alone, they're probably $150, $200 worth of materials each, or more, depending on how big it is. I refuse to sell them. There's a couple of things. One, because of my past career and them offering me a job and me feeling like I had to turn it down to be a good mom or to be a good wife or whatever, was heartbreaking, and it took the joy out of it for me. And I don't want that taken out for me, because I get a lot out of it. Two, I make quilts for LGBTQ homeless youth in Utah. I make quilts for badass, strong feminist women. I make quilts for fellow activists. I make quilts for people that inspire me. And so I won't let people pay me for that, because I don't want to be devalued by how much they would say it would was worth. So it's a gift, and that gift to me is worth more than any discussion of money. Yeah. And I think it's highly problematic that that's how women think.
Yeah.
Like hours, and I think that that's a problem. But it's how I protect myself.
It really is a problem. And I think that there's a strong, like, if for those of us who maybe grew up in the LDS church, there is this sense that our labor is not worth anything, and that our labor has no monetary value. And, you know, and that was a problem for me when I started adjuncting and, you know, moving through my career. It's not a problem anymore. But certainly other people around me perceive that as a problem. And we have to learn at some point that our labor, that we have to learn ourselves that our labor has value, and then to convince other people that our labor has value. And that's very difficult. You know, we live in a culture which is still largely accepting that, you know, that men make more than women, maybe perhaps for the same job, and that's somehow okay or justifiable in some way. And so, you know, I'm not sure what the good answer is there, but we have to insist that our labor has value.
Yeah, and for me, like, to switch it, I've been like, okay, well, like, I I will pay $25 for this bracelet that someone handmade. Like, I can understand it on the flip side. I can't do it for myself yet, and I don't know if I ever will. But I think that it's a really important conversation to have, because as we pay our childcare providers and we pay our, you know, any other work that women do, it's more and more and more and more diminished. So I don't know. For now, my solution is gifts to people I love, even if they don't love me back.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I promised.
Hi. So I've been knitting casually for 20 years and professionally for 3. I teach knitting. I work in a yarn store, and the Venn diagram of my activism friends and my craftivism knitter friends is very nearly a circle. And I have had the extreme pleasure of watching craftivists wake up to the problems within our immediate circles. Thank God for the controversial pussy hats, honestly. And watching the hat that Joanna has, this yarn is, aside from the fact that I knit it, and when I knit these, I give a portion of the proceeds to Planned Parenthood with the hope that that will help women who are in need of services to be able to have them for longer, men and women, everyone who accesses Planned Parenthood. But also, the dyer of that yarn is a small woman-owned business in Portland, Oregon, and she gives a portion of several of her yarn colorways to various charities. I have watched designers and indie dyers and shops like the one that I work in and professional knitters who knit on commission like I do over the past probably really 2 years. It's gotten exponentially larger, but this, hey, we're doing really problematic things and we need to stop that. And I'm watching people take up campaigns for knitting hats specifically for homeless youth. In Utah, there's quite a few knitters who do for LGBTQIA homeless youth. And watching in my local area, which is my metro area, is Portland, Oregon, and seeing people do that, knitting guilds and other things, start to wake up and realize we have done something not so great. All of the people involved with the Women's March knitting, not everybody accepted that maybe we were being problematic, but the ones that did got loud rather quickly in my shop. And it was really neat to see people saying, we can fix this, and start trying. And I'm wondering, in the areas that you guys are in, what have you seen as far as change? Are you seeing change? Do you expect to see more change? And what can we do as craftivists to further the conversation and be more inclusive and be less problematic in the crafting that we do?
So I want to run an organization here in Utah. It's about 11, 12,000 women. And we wore pink hats to DC and Provo. We had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hats donated. And it became a huge talking point. If it's trans inclusive, if it's women of color inclusive. And there were lots and lots of debates. And in a very short amount of time, I would say in the last 4 months, I've seen a huge, like, fundamental shift in this community. The learning curve is steep, and it's being climbed. And I find that very encouraging. I've seen them talk to their trans brothers and sisters and say, I did it wrong. What do I need to do? And they're like, I just want a pink and baby blue and white hat now, yesterday, and then it's fixed. I've heard them talk about others saying, I just need it not pink. Make it any other color. And I have seen that that's fixed immediately. And I have been to marches in Salt Lake, where there's literally rainbow colors of hats, and I love the story and the progression of what that means. And so to me, to say, like, what do other crafters need to do? It's just talk to people. Like, so, like, I made a quilt for homeless youth a couple of years. It was for Sunstone when they did that thing a couple of years ago. And then later I talked to someone who runs a homeless youth shelter here, and they're like, loved it. It was fought over. Do more or do less, but do better. Because it was intricate and everything and whatever. And so it was good to know, and it was good information, and I should have asked that community first. So I think that it's just the process. And I tell people all the time, just try, and then when you fail, just do better the next time. Because I don't want people to feel like they shouldn't be trying or doing anything in their communities, whether it's making we made Alzheimer mats in my quilt guild for I don't know how to describe them other than they're like really, really fancy, intricate fidget pads to help Alzheimer patients practice buttoning and zipping and all these other things. And that was something that the community specifically asked for. We've gone into hospitals and said, what is it you need for your newborn baby, peds population? And they're like, we need kimonos because they can't really wear onesies and they can't wear hospital gowns, but kimonos seem to be designed perfectly for medical tubes to go in babies. So we've knit hundreds of those. But going into the communities, even if you've done it wrong before, being like I made the maxi pads, mm-hmm. and I made it out of the wrong fabric. And I did it wrong. And so I don't. So like you're gonna do it wrong, but do it and then learn and then do it better and then next time learn better how to ask better. And so that's my advice.
So my crafting world seems to, where we communicate more through social media, we're finding these ways to be able to go out and ask the questions the right way. And like you've said, there's, in the last, especially since the Pussy Hats, that, oh my goodness, that, I watched, I could not go on Facebook without my Loom groups just going completely nuts. And my Loom groups have been pretty diverse, and you know, I for the one of the first times in my life felt utterly ashamed to knit and be white. I thought, oh my gosh, what have I taken away from people? And I hadn't even made any of the hats. I was like, okay, so what needs to be done? What, you know, to my fellow crafters, what do those of us need that are white that you think are, you know, throwing white privilege in your face, what do we need to do? And they said, make sure that if you're one that is doing this, that you're making sure you're giving these out to people or selling them to people that are of a diverse population. Don't just sell to all your white friends. I'm like, well, that works. And so there is this shift. There's the shift of if you're learning a craft from someone of another ethnic group, you make sure that every time, if you're going to sell what you're making, you make sure every time you know, you know, like beadwork, I learned this from the Ute Indian tribe. Or I only say beadwork because I have, I call them my daughters, but they are Ute Indians, and they have talked about the beadwork and white people, and I get angry for them. But it really is taking the time to ask the questions. When you get the great idea of, oh, I'm going to do this. For me, when I thought, okay, I'm going to do 52 hats, it wasn't I'm going to do 52 hats and take 52 hats to the shelter. It's I'm going to do 52 hats, and as I see someone in need, I'm going to give them out. It, because I knew if I approached a shelter and said, I want to make beanies, knit beanies for the shelter, how many do you think need to be knit? I knew there was no way I was going to be able to pull it off on my own. And I knew to coordinate to get the amount that would probably be needed was going to be a lot more legwork than I was able to do. So it's taking the time of when you make that decision that you're going to go out into the world and do this, that you're taking into account what you're also capable of putting out there, because if you overpromise, it's always going to come back and bite you in the butt.
Yeah, no, I just want to speak. No, it's okay. I just want to speak to this issue in my own area as well. So, you know, in our history, we are really terrible at this. You know, we are happy to say that, like, white men in Paris invented abstract art, when abstract art had been made by, like, every civilization since the dawn of day. And we're terrible at this. And I'm not exactly sure what the solution is here. I think we can teach better solutions, and we can make our students aware of what is art history and what is the practice of art history and how do we create better, more inclusive practices of art history. And that's but that is such an uphill. That is a really hard battle. There are no, I don't see any large groups of art historians engaging in steep learning curve learning about issues of race and issues of inclusivity and
depressing.
It is. It really is. And issues of intersectionality in art history, like we're not there yet. And that's a really hard thing. I feel like I'm breaking up with my discipline a little bit, or like we're taking a break, because I don't really know how to approach that problem effectively yet. And it's upsetting in very big ways.
So if you have any ideas, let Nancy know.
This will be our last question.
No. Sorry, you moved on.
Oh, I'm so sorry. We have time. We have 3 minutes.
This is different. You're talking about art, but you've haven't mentioned music. And music, that's my love. And I've gone to parties where there are disc jockeys playing huge volumes of noise. One of them walked away and said, "I'm a musician." He didn't know anything about music, and he was making the money. It's just one of the things that I think we need to consider is the quality and the thoughtfulness. And you people put in a lot of time and a lot of thought, and serious musicians also do. And I think that's just another part of art to consider.
Final thoughts?
Just to kind of address the music a little bit, I am a classically trained singer. So I can do a little bit of the opera stuff, not well, but I can. And for a long time, I held a lot of what you said. That was almost how I felt about what I was hearing, other than I do like more common genres of music as well. I'm pretty well-rounded in the music I hear out there. And then I started learning how people, the DJs that make the music, the sounds like just racket. I started researching how they create, and where they don't have my knowledge of music and my background and my understanding of music theory and that, if you set me down with the kinds of equipment that they use, I would be completely lost. And where it isn't the music I like, it is a craft. It is a skill set that they don't just sit down one day and do. It's something that they have to hone over a lot of years. And so even if we don't like it, I think out of respect to the work that they've done, we need to at least go, you know, there is a level of work in that, and I think that comes with any kind of art that is being done, whether it's photography, painting, quilting, cloth making, you know, any of it. If someone has the different skill set than we do, we need to be able to appreciate their skill set and say, it's not mine. I like where they're going with it, though. They're making an effort. They're putting the time and the energy and their creative thought into it. And just uphold that and realize that there is an innate value in it, because there's an innate value in the person who has been creating it.
I say a lot now. I think that it was Angela Davis that I first heard it from. She said, get comfortable with being really, really uncomfortable. And maybe she didn't say it. She might have been quoting someone else. I find that in use everywhere, and including crafting and music and art and anything. And that is that I'm a terrible quilter, actually, comparatively to women in my guild. I mean, legitimately, I'm terrible compared to them. But they've given me a space to be comfortable, and being uncomfortable with them so I can learn with them. I'm teaching my children how to quilt, and they're terrible compared to me. And I'm comfortable with them being, you know, terrible so that they can learn. And I love that life is just this learning process. And so I don't understand other people's art. I don't understand other people's expression of themselves, but I want to be comfortable with learning about why and how they got there. That's where I'm going to leave that. Yeah.
And I think the issue about taste is really different from what we've been talking about today. We also didn't talk about music because this is a session on crafting. But thank you, everybody, for being here and for participating in this conversation. And I think we're going to end it there. Thank you. Thank you.